Morning, everybody. I'd like to call together the first meeting in this new year of the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Committee. Welcome, everyone. Happy New Year. We're going to have, I think, an exciting year ahead of us. Challenging and full of opportunities. So I'd just like to call your attention to a couple of things in the folder. We do have a listing of our committee membership with all our mugshots, and that might be helpful. And we're going to have some introductions this morning where people can elaborate a little bit on who they are, where they represent, and I am going to ask you when you introduce yourself to just say a little bit about what you hope to bring to this committee, what you'd like this committee to be working on. And we are going to hear from our two agencies that this committee oversees, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Minnesota Department of Health. So we'll have time for both of those today, and we have a couple of announcements. One of them I want to start with, we have determined that our next meeting is exactly during the time, overlapping the time of the inauguration. And rather than miss a lot of you from, you know, not showing up or not being here, or including the chair might want to see that inaugural event, what we've decided to do is to cancel that meeting, but to extend our next meeting a half hour each direction. So we'll start at 10 instead of 10:30, and we'll end at 12:30 instead of 12. And unless there's a big objection to that, but it does, the room is available, the time is available, and unless you all want to come and be here for the meeting next Tuesday, I think that seems like that'll be the good way to work it out. In your packet are a list of the procedures for this committee. And, you have it there? Okay, good. Thank you. And it's pretty straightforward. This committee operates like most all of the other committees in the House. We'll try to start our meetings on time, and we'll move to this room. And I wanted to just tell you a little bit about what happened there. The Agriculture Finance Committee decided they'd like to be in the room that we were previously in, and partly it has to do with some access to rural Minnesota in terms of some of the telecommunications resources that are in that room and not in this room. So we're honoring that, but we have also said that if we have something that we really think we'd like to have televised, then we want to reclaim our old room, and they've agreed to that as far as I know, right? Okay. You can just look down the list of procedures here. We'll be taking roll at the beginning. The rule about amendments is, again, pretty typical. If you have a substantial amendment, please get that to our committee legislative assistants 24 hours in advance and bring 50 copies. But we can waive that rule if it needs to. So just talk to me about that if you have an amendment that's not going to make the rule. We'd like to try to do that just to kind of keep the committee operating or in an orderly fashion. Minor oral amendments can certainly be accepted during the hearing if at my discretion. And they need to be written up. That's the one thing that we've found over the years, that if you have an oral amendment, please at least work with the staff here in the committee to get it written. Anything that you want to save, in the save part of the folder. Please submit a written request for your hearings to Jake. So we will try to hear all the bills that committee members bring forward, and it's usually my policy that we try to hear any bill that comes to this committee if at all possible. So please get those hearing requests in, and then just the usual about turning off your cell phones and trying to make sure that we don't have disruptions from beepers and so on. So I think, other than that, the committee rules are pretty typical, and unless there's any questions about that, I'd like to begin with introductions. And so again, if each committee member could introduce themselves. Some of you have been on the committee before, and I welcome you back, and we also have some brand new members. I think it's going to be an exceptionally good committee, so we'll go ahead and start with the Republican lead.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair. I'm good to be on the committee again. This is my second time on the committee, and it's a very I'm sorry. Dan Stevenson and I represent District 14A, which is Sartell-Stock Rapids, Central Minnesota, Stearns-Benton County. And this is my fourth term in the legislature, second term on this committee, and I'm looking forward to it. I think we've got some ominous clouds on the horizon here, and interestingly enough, housing seems to have been one of the huge perpetrators in this downturn in the market here, at least an indicator of the economy. So I think we'll have some interesting topics brought forward here. Looking forward to hearing from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and some of the things that we will be able to discern from that process, and hopefully make some difference in the housing market. Obviously, housing is a huge issue for affordable housing, for the needy, and for transitional housing. So there's some good topics. I think we'll have a fun time and appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Carol McFarland. I represent 53D, White Bear, White Bear Township, and part of North Oak. This is my second term and my second time on this committee, and I'm happy to be here. Some of my background is helpful when I come here. I was very involved in an affordable housing roundtable group in my community, getting it started and feeling the importance of safe housing and affordable housing for all people in the state. Also, I'm a forward school board member, and I realize how important it is on everything is not just in silos around here. Our children need a safe place to live. They need to have food and clothing and everything else to go into the environment to be good at students. And so I see the importance of all of it, and I think we need to take a big picture look at all of these things. Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies for being late. The traffic was crazy this morning, very slow.
Yeah. My name is Peggy Scott, and I'm a freshman this year. I represent Andover and Ham Lake, which is District 49A, and I'm very happy to be on this committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm Rita Saylor, District 2B, from way up north, Clearwater, Hubbard, Beltrami, Polk, Pennington, portions thereof. And, of course, housing issues and public health are certainly big issues for us. I'm very interested in housing in particular, so I'm glad to be able to be part of this committee, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Benson. This is my second round here with this committee. I represent District 43B, which is the northern half of the city of Minnetonka and a few about a southern third of the city of Plymouth. And this committee became very engaging to me because although I've always been extremely interested in K-12 education, early childhood education, all the studies indicate not only for children and their families, but also those who are economically stressed or have psychological issues, and so that if we can secure affordable, stable housing for individuals and have access to health care, many of these other issues having to do with education and a whole panoply of social issues can be dealt with so much more effectively. So I'm looking forward to what we do this year, especially now with the economic downturn. I think the importance of this committee has greatly increased in the minds of the public, as well as maybe our colleagues here in the legislature. So thank you, and I look forward to participation.
My new members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Larry House. This is my sixth term. I represent Cass, Crowing, and Hubbard counties. This is my first time on this committee, and I volunteered. I'm wondering why, but I did. my district, I always brag that I have more golf courses and lakes than anybody else, but since this committee deals with housing, my district, I believe the last percentage I heard was 81% home ownership. So that's good. So I'm looking forward to this committee.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm Representative David Bly. I'm in my second term and my first time serving on this committee. I'm looking forward to working on it, and I would echo some of the comments of my esteemed colleague, John Benson, and that a good home, good safe home, is one of the most important things in a good education. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Representative Will Morgan. I'm from Burnsville. I also represent part of Savage in the South Metro. I'm back for a second term here at the legislature and also a second term on this committee. I look forward to working on some of these issues that affect all of our communities, stable housing, as Representative Benson mentioned, and also public health issues, particularly for our children, I think are very important in preparing them for to be lifelong learners and be as successful as possible in the classroom and help stimulate our economy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Rosenthal. I apologize for being so low, but I have a chair malfunction.
part of the hazing process.
I represent District 41B, which is West Bloomington and Southern Edina. This is my first term. My background is in early on in community organizing and urban studies, and I'd like to echo what Representative Benson had to say. I'm really looking forward to working on this committee, and I'm ready to get to work, and thank you.
Thank you. Glad and we'll try to see if we can to elevate you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and Danny McNamara from 57B down in Hastings, and thank you, Madam Chair, for reminding me what I said 2 years ago when I got on this committee, that I don't know why I'm here, I don't have any interest, and I won't be saying much. the chair reminded me that I had a way to end up speaking up a lot. This is a really cool committee, and I'm really excited to be back here. We've got some really, really important stuff to do as we go forward, dealing with the challenges, and I look forward to working with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Hayden, and I represent District 61B, which is South Minneapolis. And I am excited to be on this committee. I've worked on a lot of the issues that I think that this committee is going to have to tackle, homelessness, supportive housing, the foreclosure issue, just to name a few. My district has been hit especially hard with the foreclosure crisis, and working on those issues to make sure that we not only rehab or rebuild our housing stock, but make sure that the people that have been displaced get an opportunity to move back into their communities are very, there are issues that are very important to me. The other thing on the public health spectrum is the increasing violence in my district and others that surround it, I think has risen to the level that it's become a public health issue for people, for a lot of young people that live in my district, in terms of it being I don't know what the stats may say, but I know that it is a leading cause of death in my community, as other more traditional diseases are. So I would love to have conversations and explore what we can do to help with that issue. So thanks again.
Our new vice chair.
Yes, I'm Carolyn Lane from Columbia Heights, Ridley, a little bit of St. Anthony. And my second term, second time on this committee, also, as others have said, the housing crisis is and the increased homelessness that will come out of this is a key function of this committee. But also, perhaps we can do some things around policy, around toxins. Both of those things affect the well-being of our children and their effectiveness in school.
Thank you. And I'll just briefly introduce myself before we get to the really important people, our staff here. Karen Clark, and I do represent three neighborhoods in South Minneapolis, just north of Representative Hayden, the Whittier neighborhood, Stevens Square neighborhood, and Phillips neighborhood. And I just want to say that one of my perspectives in chairing this committee and hoping to provide some good leadership is to really make the connections between the two issues of housing and public health. There are a lot of connections. Some of them have been mentioned by some of you already. And I think we'll see as we go forward that how they are connected. Last year we had a subcommittee on healthy housing and environmental justice, and we probably will have something like that again as we look at what work we need to do. But there are some very important issues that link those two, and I just wanted to bring that out as something that I think we can work on. Let's hear from our staff. Introduce themselves. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jake Johnson. I'm the committee legislative assistant. This is my second session working for the committee, and I'm looking forward to working with you all.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Brooke Boydson, the committee administrator for this committee. This will be my third go-around, and it's nice to see everybody.
Thank you. Melba?
Melba Ranchi, I'm a lead sister with the DFL Caucus. This is my third session in this committee. I also was at the Senate working for the caucus for 10 years.
Joe Marble, I'm Republican House Research for this. I did it, this committee the last 2 years. It may be more temporary this session. I've been assigned to another committee, but temporarily I'll be covering when needed.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Emily Cleveland with House Research, and I cover the health department programs and any health-related issues.
Danielle Lemire from House Research, and I'll be covering the housing issues.
Okay. Emily.
My name is Emily Adrians, and I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee, so if you have questions regarding fiscal notes or anything regarding money, I can help you on that.
I just want to encourage all members, we're going to meet a couple more folks working with us, but I just want to encourage all members to use these folks for any kinds of research and input. They have tremendous expertise and would be a really good resource for all of us. We have two pages. I'd like to have you introduce yourself. So just speak up. Why don't you come forward a little bit so we can hear you a little more easily.
I'm Erica McCallum, and I'm a student at Thursday.
Okay, and where are you from?
I grew up in South Minneapolis, and I'm living in Colorado. And I'm from Richmond, by the way, Syria, and I'm a student at
Okay, great. Welcome. I do have an intern that's working with me this year, particularly on some of the issues around environmental health. And Lisa, will you just stand up, please? Thank you. All right. Is there anybody else that we that a member wants to introduce or have introduced? Okay. Well, then, I just want to say welcome, everyone. I think we do have a lot of work, a lot of challenges before us. And as was pointed out, I think it is true that the issues of housing and especially some of the crises that we're facing are much higher on the radar of the public right now. So we have a lot of opportunities as well as challenges, and that's the kind of attitude that I like to see us go forward with. So we're going to start right out with hearing from our Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, an overview, and I believe Ms. Tanya Orr and Jeanette Frankenship will be presenting to us this morning. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tanya Orr. I'm the Assistant Commissioner with the Housing Finance Agency. I'm Jeanette Blankenship and Housing Policy with the agency. Commissioner Bartholomew sends his regrets. He had a previously scheduled meeting that he was not able to reschedule. So you're stuck with the two of us. Today we were going to try and provide you with a sense of how the Housing Finance Agency is structured and some broad description of agency activities. We're not going to spend any time on the budget. We're assuming that you'll have us back and maybe back and back to talk about the budget. We also are going to end with a little bit of a description of what we see as sort of the big housing trends that influence our actions in the next couple of years. So Jeanette is going to start with the overview of the agency structure and program.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Clark and members of the committee. Again, I'm Jeanette Blankenship, and I'll be covering kind of our mission and our programs while Tanya will go over the key housing trends that are impacting our work today. Minnesota's housing mission is to finance and advance affordable housing opportunities for low and moderate income Minnesotans to enhance quality of life and foster strong communities. The agency works to accomplish this mission by focusing on four strategic priorities. We finance new affordable housing opportunities, preserve existing affordable housing, and long-term homelessness, and increase emerging market homeownership. Just to give you a sense of our organizational structure, while our Commissioner Dan Bartholomew is appointed by Governor Pawlenty, the management and control of the agency is vested solely in the members of our Board of Directors by statute. Now, using bond sales, proceeds, agency resources, federal resources, and appropriated funds, Minnesota Housing offers various types of housing-related assistance ranging from below market, interest rate first mortgages for eligible first-time homebuyers, to incentives for to rental property owners for construction of new and the preservation of existing affordable housing. So I'm going to go a little bit over our credit that looks at our resources and uses. Our largest source of financing is the sale of revenue bonds, which account for 52% of the resources available for new activity in our last affordable housing plan. Because many of the bonds sold are tax exempt, they carry a lower interest rate, allowing the agency to provide financing at below market rate interest rates to qualifying low and moderate income first-time homebuyers and to sponsors of affordable housing for low and moderate income renters. Now, federal appropriations from HUD, primarily Section 8 housing assistance payments, account for nearly 24% of our resources. Agency resources, which enable us to maximize leverage in housing assistance, account for 14%. And Minnesota Housing uses state appropriations, which comprise 9.4% of Minnesota Housing's resources for 2008 and 2009, to provide deferred loans, grants, and other housing subsidies to low-income households. In the last biennium, the state appropriated about $114 million to the agency, about $90 million of which was base funding. State appropriations are the most flexible use of source of funds and allow the agency to meet its mission of serving the most vulnerable, allow us to leverage funds, and allow us to respond swiftly to housing emergencies such as foreclosures or the floods in southeast Minnesota. With these program resources, the agency assisted nearly 59,000 Minnesota households last year to the amount of $745 million. We dedicated nearly 59% of our financing to new affordable housing opportunities, which includes increasing emerging market homeownership, 37% on preserving existing affordable housing, and almost 5% on ending long-term homelessness. It's important to note that the agency's operating budget is not funded through state appropriations. In fiscal year 2008, the agency's operating costs were $24 million, which includes payroll for approximately 200 employees and all other expenses. We benchmark our operating costs with other similar banks and ensure that it is always below 4.5% of total state the total assistance that we provide. The primary revenue source is the difference between the rate at which we borrow the money through single-family bonds and the rate at which it is loaned. Now, for the purposes of the state budget, we group our programs into five activity areas. Development and redevelopment, which accounts for about 33% of state appropriations, homeownership loans, homelessness prevention and supportive housing, preservation of existing housing, and resident and organizational support. I'm going to go through each of these five areas at about a 30,000-foot level, so bear with me. Now, the development and redevelopment activity area serves low and moderate income wage earners. You are likely most familiar with the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, which is funded through state appropriations, as well as the Urban Indian and Tribal Indian Housing Program. These programs provide deferred loans for both rental and owner-occupied housing. As part of the agency's strategic priority to finance new affordable housing opportunities, other activities include first mortgages for rental properties, also known in our world as Lemire, the Home Rental Rehab Program, and federal housing tax credits. All newly constructed housing, both ownership and rental, must comply with the Green Communities criteria with the Minnesota Overlay, which is a set of green building standards for affordable housing developers. Homeownership loans, which serve first-time homebuyers, provide deferred loans for down payment assistance, known to our partners as HAF and ADDI, and first mortgages, also known as MMP. These loans are originated by financial institutions and mortgage lenders, then purchased by Minnesota Housing. The Emerging Market Homeownership Initiative is part of this homeownership loan activity. This initiative addresses disparities in homeownership rates between households of color and white households. This gap was 34% last year, one of the highest in the nation, and although lending is down somewhat with the markets, the agency did exceed its 2008 goal of 16% of our mortgage loans going to people of color. Now, homelessness prevention and supportive housing activity area serves the continuum of at-risk, homeless, and long-term homeless populations. the three state appropriated programs that address this, the homelessness continuum, are the Family Homeless Prevention Program, the Housing Trust Fund, and Bridges. Delivered through local HRAs, CAPs, counties, for-profit and non-profit developers, these programs provide rental assistance, temporary assistance to resolve a housing emergency, operating subsidies, and financial assistance with the capital cost of rental housing for very low-income households. Now, the business plan to end long-term homelessness, a part of that, is currently on target. You'll see it exceeded its 2008 cumulative total goal. Minnesota Housing has financed 2,492 new housing opportunities to date to serve the long-term homeless. The next 2 years will be a challenge to meet our ambitious goal of 4,000 units by 2010. In addition to the ongoing challenge of operating subsidies to maintain supportive housing and provide necessary services, federal operating assistance has been insufficient to support the state's efforts to end long-term homelessness. But even in the short-term downturn that we're experiencing, we must remember that ending long-term homelessness is a long-term goal and a long-term reform of how we've approached it. The next activity, preservation of existing housing, serves low-income households through programs to preserve the existing housing stock that we have in the state. State appropriations provide deferred and amortizing loans to rehabilitate homes through the Rehabilitation Loan Program and the Fix-Up Fund, and for rental properties through the Affordable Rental Investment Fund, also known as CARIF. The agency also assists private owners to continue participation in federally assisted housing programs, such as Section 8. While we are increasing our preservation efforts, both for homeowners and for subsidized rental properties, we are also very cognizant of the fact that federally assisted rental housing stock is threatened, and operating subsidies are failing to meet the ongoing maintenance needs. Finally, resident and organizational support assists in strengthening the partner delivery infrastructure that is necessary to effectively deliver affordable housing. Examples of this activity area include funding for home buyer education and foreclosure prevention counseling, which is especially relevant in times like these, but something we've been doing for decades and that many homeowners need. And we also contribute, for example, to capacity building for operational support for nonprofit developers to help them gain capacity to develop the projects that are needed to affordably house Minnesotans. Now, a couple things I want you to remember. In these program areas, Minnesota Housing is primarily a financing source. The agency is not an originator, owner, or developer. All of these are implemented through important delivery partners. Financing is accessed through three different delivery methods. Loans to individuals, which are originated by lenders on a pipeline basis, and then sold to Minnesota Housing, which kind of makes us a secondary market. And then we receive applications from organizations on a pipeline basis. And we also use requests for proposals. For example, the Challenge Fund, we have two rounds each year. Now, as I have said, Minnesota Housing's mission is to finance and advance affordable housing opportunities for low and moderate income Minnesotans. This chart and table are helpful to understand what this means. The median income of renters that we assist is $12,241. The median income last year of first-time homebuyers was $39,781. 78% of our resources go to households earning less than $30,000. Now, with that 30,000 level overview of the agency's programs, I'm going to turn it over to Tanya, who will provide you with the additional context for the major trends impacting our work.
Madam Chair, is life we could take questions now, or do you want to wait till the end? Which would you prefer?
Are there any burning questions? Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Blankenship, in the home ownership loan area and the emerging market home ownership initiative, obviously all of our communities have really been hit hard by foreclosures. Do you know what the foreclosure rate is for the work you've done, Minnesota Housing, in those two areas?
Yes, we do. You're jumping ahead in our presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But on slide 23, we'll get to that.
Okay, thank you.
Tanya will explain that. Thank you.
Sometimes Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question, just wondering if you could extrapolate a little bit on the regional planning, what do you mean by that exactly? Just a little bit more about that, I would like to know. Thank you.
I'll defer to Tommy for this.
We have, Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, we have two major regional planning activities. One is we fund what we call RAGs, which are Regional Housing Advisory Groups, in the six regions in Greater Minnesota. They're the initiative fund regions. And those groups meet, they're groups of people who are interested in housing. So they could be housing developers, bankers, realtors, business owners. They're usually organized by the initiative funds. The groups meet, some of them meet on a monthly basis, some of them meet maybe a couple of times a year. And the idea was that it would be an opportunity for the state agencies and local units, people to talk about what the housing needs are and what housing activities are occurring in the region. So we fund, you know, the gathering of those people on a periodic basis. We also fund a continuum of care planning process, which is for accessing McKinney-Vento funding from the federal government. In order to access that money, you have to have a continuum of care plan, that takes some effort in terms of both putting together the plan, doing a survey of what housing is available for people who are homeless and at risk of homelessness, and then putting together the application. The McKinney-Vento money is a considerable resource for addressing homelessness issues, and we think that it's important for the state to invest in the planning so that we can maximize the federal resources that are available. That's available on a competitive basis, and Minnesota has competed quite successfully for that money.
Madam Chair, thank you. Couple of questions. The web-based database, is that HousingLink?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
And secondly, the Challenge Fund, could you extrapolate a little bit more on that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the Challenge Fund is, the full name is the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program. It started out as a one-time only program when we were hearing a lot from businesses about how the lack of housing was impairing their ability to expand. And the challenge part of it is that a portion of the money has to be used in projects where there is a contribution from a non-state resource, either from a local unit of government, an employer, or a philanthropic organization. So the state is putting up money but saying somebody else outside the state has to contribute to the housing. It is a program that is very flexible in terms of there's virtually no activity other than demolition that cannot be funded with the Challenge Fund. That was like three negatives. That was a really poorly constructed fund. Sorry. It also has a lot of flexibility in terms of the incomes that it can serve. For homeowners, it can serve incomes up to 115% of median, and for renters, it can serve renters up to 80% of median. And that was purposeful so that it would be a program that recognized that in some areas of the state, you may have workers who can't afford market rate housing without some assistance, but have incomes that are higher than maybe you would find in Representative Clark's district or Representative Hayden's
district. Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Orr, on the homeless prevention and supportive housing program, specifically on the three-state appropriate programs, Family Housing and Prevention, Housing Trust Fund, and Bridges, were those programs fully utilized last year?
Madam Chair, okay. Representative Hayden, absolutely. We actually have about, $200 left in the Housing Trust Fund or something. The Family Homeless Prevention Program, in some communities, about 10 days into the month, they've run out of what their monthly allotment is for family homeless prevention activities. The 2 years ago, that program was doubled. While we were able to expand the scope of it into some additional counties, with the economic crisis, we're seeing lots of demands for that money. The Bridges program, similarly, that money gets committed right away and is fully utilized.
Any other questions? I did have one, Ms. Blankenship. You mentioned that in several places that the services that go along with the housing, supportive housing and others, is inadequate. Do you have a, can you quantify that for us?
Trying to start, Madam
Chair. There is a flexible service fund that state appropriation to the Department of Human Services, and that was purposely designed to sort of fill in the gaps where the Main Street services don't work for people who are long-term homeless, and that is about $10 million a biennium. Right now, it is barely sufficient to cover the housing opportunities that we have funded so far. We, frankly, are very concerned about going forward as we commit new housing opportunities that the service dollars won't be there. We have a sort of unrealistic in terms of it, given the deficit. Estimate of what we would need, and we're working to refine what we think that we could, what we really need if we were able to meet that 1,600 goal over the next 2 years of new housing opportunities. The $10 million will not quite sustain the opportunities that we have funded so far.
Okay. And can you remind this committee what those services are that are not being funded?
Madam Chair, they range from things like helping someone find housing to helping someone to remember to take their medications to helping them with finding employment. It's very flexible and is individually tailored to the household.
Okay. No, any other questions? Let me continue on with the presentation. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I was just going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we're seeing right now and we expect will influence the activities and how we deliver services over the next couple of years. As you all know, we are facing a foreclosure and a subprime mortgage crisis. We've seen a 35% increase in foreclosures from 2007 to 2008. There were as many foreclosures in the first three quarters of 2008 as there were in the entire four quarters of 2007. So we are now up to just under 28,000 foreclosures a year in this state. I haven't seen any really Minnesota-specific projections about what we should expect in the next year, but a lot of people have expressed concerns about the increased number of prime loans that are going into foreclosure. So we don't know that we're going to see a leveling off of foreclosures at this point.
Madam
Chair, and Ms. Orr, maybe you could, for the committee here, and I just explain what is a prime loan here.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, a prime loan is essentially a loan that's for someone with, usually it's someone with good credit, and it's an interest rate that reflects that good credit and a reasonable level of down payment for the home. So it's a loan that's I can't tell you the exact interest rate because it varies about when you've taken out the loan, but it's a loan that's sort of a level that's not substantially above the Treasury or tax exempt bond interest rate. So it's an interest rate that reflects the level of risk, which is considered pretty low because somebody has good credit and because they put some money down on their house.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have been, the Housing Finance Agency has been quite active in the last, particularly in the last couple of years, in the area of foreclosure prevention, remediation, and providing some new products that we hope will help with the foreclosure crisis. As you may remember, we received a substantial amount of federal money for foreclosure prevention counseling last year, and that money was actually renewed this fall. So we have, in the last couple of years, had a total of $12 million available for foreclosure counseling. In the first 6 months of this federal money, so from about April until September of 2008, 3,200 households received foreclosure prevention counseling. About 18% of those households were in greater Minnesota. There are different levels of counseling that are provided. There's some brief phone call counseling, and there's some really intensive counseling. And the positive outcomes from that counseling range from about 62% to 75%. Now, a positive outcome means that somebody was able to modify their loan, was able to work out a repayment agreement with the lender or servicer. It could also mean that the house was sold before there was a foreclosure, so that they don't have a foreclosure on the on their credit rate rating, but they may not be able to stay in their home. Minnesota had, at least in the first 6 months, one of the highest positive outcomes of all the states reporting that this federal foreclosure money. We do have some work to do in terms of making sure that more of the people that are served are people who get more intensive services as opposed to just the phone call. We also were somewhat disappointed to find that Minnesota had one of the highest percentages of households who were 120 days delinquent by the time that they called for prevention counseling. We have been making a real effort to try and intervene at an earlier point, and we will be working even harder to improve those statistics. Because obviously, the sooner people get into counseling, the more likely it is we will be able to counsel them into a positive outcome. We also
Representative Hayden?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Commissioner Orr, I just have two questions before we move forward. Does the statistic about the successful outcomes from working with a mortgage foreclosure counselor taking effect, short sales, would that be something that you would look at as to say that was a success that they sold the house, or would that be reflected as something that was negative?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm going to double check, but I believe that short sales are considered a positive outcome. Yes.
So it's reflected as a positive outcome. However, they could have money that they still owe that. So it may not be a positive outcome from the, a total positive outcome from the, for the seller.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct. It's, we are, I don't have any firm data, but I have heard some anecdotal information that banks are pursuing delinquency adjustments.
Okay. Madam Chair, Commissioner Orr, the 120 days delinquent reflective of people not being able to, or not they don't know who to call or where to call. Who do you contract with agencies in the community in which to do mortgage foreclosure counseling, or is that done directly at the agency?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, no, we contact with agencies all over the state. The Lutheran Social Services is the largest provider of foreclosure prevention counseling and credit counseling in greater Minnesota. In Minneapolis, we have a number of organizations that provide counseling. The Urban League, I'm sort of blanking on the rest of them, but we have a number of them. So there's Southside offices or Northside offices, and I think the Dakota County EBA or CBA is a foreclosure prevention counselor. So it's a real mix of nonprofits, HRAs, local units of government. It's all we have substantially increased the number of counselors. We're now up to 77 counselors throughout the state, and that's like a tripling of the counselors in the last year and a half.
Madam Chair, one more follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Ward, have you found that the outcomes are better as you've increased counselors, or is it an issue of marketing the product or the service in the community?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I don't have comparison data, so I can't tell you whether we have more positive outcomes as we've increased counselors. We clearly are serving more people. And there has been an increased emphasis on trying to get people in earlier. The past practice had been to spend the most time with people who are days away from the sheriff's sale. It's hard to have a positive outcome at that point. So I think that there's a likelihood that if we had comparison data, we would find that there are more positive outcomes, but I can't say that for certain.
So just along those lines, I think you indicated that there may be a need for more concentrated counseling services, and then you compare that to a phone call. So is most of the counseling handled by phone, or can you just describe what the typical counseling scene involves?
Madam Chair, they've actually employed a number of strategies to try and get to people. So they've had these fairs where in Minneapolis and St. Paul, the mayors have actually sent out letters saying, we're going to have this fair, you can come, we're going to have banks there, services there to talk to you, we'll have counselors there. And they've had a really good turnout with a number of those fairs. They've also had conference calls where you don't have to appear someplace, but you can get on the phone and you can get some basic information about counseling and what you can do to help yourself, and then you can get connected to a servicer to help you. So that's, you have some anonymity with that, and that has been successful as well. They've been doing flyers in with utility bills, city water and sewer bills, to remind people that this counseling is available. So people can call and stop in, and they have, I think they get more initial phone calls than they do have people stopping in, but it's a variety of things.
And, sir, are there multilingual services being offered?
Madam Chair, there are in some areas of the state, yes.
And do you know which populations are serving?
Madam Chair, my recollection is that there are services in Spanish, and I believe in Somali, and there may be some in Russian. At some point, we had some in Russian.
Okay, thank you.
In addition to the prevention counseling, we have also engaged in some neighborhood remediation activities. We have made both loans and grants to communities to address the devastation in their neighborhoods that is caused by concentration of foreclosures. Many of you know, we also received a substantial amount of federal money in September. We were awarded it in September. And that is intended to deal with neighborhoods that have been destabilized as a result of concentrations of foreclosures. This money is $38.8 million is available to the agency. We are accepting applications through the end of January. We, under federal law, we are required to focus these, give priority emphasis and consideration to areas that had high percentages of loans and foreclosures, high percentages of subprime loans, and were likely to see an increase in foreclosures. We have developed a formula, and of the 800 and some zip codes in Minnesota, we have focused the money, availability of money, on 37 zip codes and 23 counties. So we will have a competitive process for some of the funds among the 23 counties, and we have split the pools into Greater Minnesota and the metro area. And we are asking communities to provide us with comprehensive plans. So we don't want to see a plan that just says we're going to acquire X number of properties and rehab them and sell them. But we want communities to tell us what other resources are they bringing to bear. How are they addressing crime issues? How are they addressing parks and school issues, transportation issues? We know that while housing is an important part of stabilizing these neighborhoods, that's not going to be the only thing that's going to get the neighborhood stabilized. So we are going to be examining very carefully these plans to make sure that they are looking in a holistic manner. We have recently heard that as part of the economic stimulus package of the incoming administration, that this program, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, is likely to be refunded at about the same level as it was before. So we're hopeful that we'll be getting a similar amount of money into the state sometime later this year. The federal money can be used for a number of activities, and we have chosen not to limit the activities which we had the option to, but we're going to allow communities to use the money for all of the federally eligible activities. The only limitation we've imposed is that you're not going to use housing money to demolish commercial property. We also have imposed the requirements that any rehab that's done with the federal money must meet some green standards, meaning that there needs to be some energy conservation and some healthy home activities in relationship to the rehabilitation. We have also, in connection with foreclosure, the foreclosure crisis, provided money to help people buy foreclosed and vacant homes. And we have done two things. We have provided federal home dollars as down payment assistance that is targeted to areas that have seen a lot of foreclosures and vacant homes. And we've made $9 million available for that assistance. And it's actually been a very successful program in terms of we're seeing a lot of demand for that money. And the other thing is we have recently developed a mortgage product that would combine money for acquisition with money for rehabilitation. This is the FHA has a program that's fairly complicated, and we think we've simplified the program a little bit. The idea is that if you can buy a foreclosed home that often needs some rehab, and we can provide you with the money for the rehab as well as the acquisition in one loan, that might be an incentive to look there as opposed to someplace else for your home. We've committed $10 million in mortgage money to that program. It's just getting launched in the last month, and we're hopeful that that will be another tool for cities to get their vacant and foreclosed homes back into habitable condition and help with the vibrancy of their neighborhoods. Page 23 gives you some information about the agency's portfolio performance. The thing that I would like to note is that we do have a foreclosure rate that is below the state benchmark. You'll notice that our delinquency rate is a little higher than the benchmark, but the end result is we work with people through our servicers and counselors, and they don't end up in foreclosure. Well, this rate has been going up, but not obviously at the same rate as the rest of the industry. A couple of other things I'd like to note. On page 27, you'll see a chart about employment. We obviously the unemployment rate has increased. One of the hardest hit industries is the residential construction industry. They're from the second quarter of 2005 to the second quarter of 2008, they had the highest percentage loss of jobs. It was 28%. And the highest numerical loss of jobs was almost 17,000 jobs lost. These are skilled laborers, they're unskilled laborers. It's a whole variety of jobs. We can help with that situation. The more money we spend on rehab, the more people that we can put back to work. So we think it's important to think about not just the money that you spend on housing to help people get affordably housed, but it also, in many cases, will put somebody back to work. And this is an area that has been very hard hit, and we're very cognizant of that, and are trying very hard to think about how we use our money so that it gets out the door very quickly and gets used in a way that will put people to work as quickly as possible.
So if I could just interrupt for a second. I'm just aware a little bit of the time, and I'm wondering if you are comfortable hitting just a few high points for the remaining presentation. We'll have you back, and if members are okay with that, because we do have the Commissioner of Health here, and we do want to have a chance to hear from her, too.
Madam Chair, the only other thing, you can read the slides for yourself. There are a couple of pieces of information about the connection between housing and transportation and housing and education and housing and energy conservation and healthy homes. We think that all of these issues are important, and we're very cognizant that there are connections between these issues and try and use our programs to advance not just housing but these other issues as well. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Any questions from anyone? Representative Stevenson?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Orr, you know, this, as I talked about in opening it, you know, this is, I think when we take a look at what has precipitated some of this, the whole concept of affordable housing has, while it's a worthy goal, has put some significant constraints on our housing market. And I think some of the things, and I'll just speak frankly, you know, from my community in the areas where we were strongly encouraged going to the affordable housing market, where there were taxpayer subsidized monies to get people who were on the cusp of whether they were really legal or able to maintain those payments, were pushed into a house. Now when we get into a downturn in the economy, their ability to make those payments has definitely diminished. So that goes into foreclosure. So you got the taxpayer paying on the front end to subsidize to get people into the housing. Now when it comes off the market, now you're asking for more monies to fix up the house so that we can present it to some new people who, in fact, may be questionable as to whether they can meet the challenge. Those are the things that I think we need to address in this community to say, how can we create a system that creates a long-term solution and not something that's just going to infuse money to create a false sense of security so the next wave that's coming down the pike here, and I don't believe that we have seen it all yet. I think there's some new ARM loans and some of the other ones that are coming down the pike here. We're going to see some significant foreclosure rates increase on it. That's not good news. And so how do we address those? And I think this committee, Madam Chair, has a responsibility of laying that out, and not in a partisan or any kind of political way, but to say, what is a viable housing solution for Minnesota? And so I hope we can get into some of those issues as we progress, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again at the desk here.
Madam Chair, if I could just respond really quickly.
Sure.
I think that the state housing finance agencies are one of the best protections. We are able to offer loans at below market interest rates, which means that the loans are more affordable. As you can see from the slides about our portfolio performance, we have a foreclosure rate that is below the state benchmark. So compare us to the rest of the industry in the state. We have a foreclosure rate that's below that. And that is because we don't make subprime loans. We look at whether somebody can afford this loan. We have set house price limits, so we don't say, oh yeah, go out and buy a $300,000 house. That's not who we're trying to serve, and not that the sort of housing that we're trying to get people into for their first home. So we provide counseling. We provide down payment assistance. We provide a viable mortgage. And the result of that is that we don't see the foreclosure rate that others are experiencing. And I think that that is one of the best housing programs that that the state can support, because it has demonstrated that it's able to serve like 3,000 new home buyers, first-time home buyers every year, And those are successful home buyers. They're not people who get into a house and then have to give it up after a year.
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner Orr, so what I hear you saying is that it wasn't the taxpayer money that funded first-time homeowners that provided affordable housing throughout the state and Representative Stevenson's district that foreclosed by and large. It was the private market subprime loans that really precipitated this foreclosure crisis that we're in. I mean, I know it's a pretty wide statement to make, but it doesn't sound like to me and you saying that it was the agency's portfolio that really got us into the situation.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct. The agency has a double A plus bond rating. Part of what the rating agencies look at is how are we doing on collecting money so that we can pay the bondholders, and we continue to do an excellent job, and there aren't any concerns in the rating agencies about the mortgages, the underlying mortgages that we've made that are the source of revenue for to pay the bonds.
This provides a perfect opening for me to just invite all of you to something that is bipartisan, bicameral, that you all should have received, those of you who are ongoing members or were members before. There is a housing caucus that's been established for legislators. Senator Mimu and I started bringing people together throughout the summer, fall, winter, and you all received an invitation, those of you who are here. So those of you who are new, there will be a reconvening of that housing caucus, of House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans. I think before the end of January, we will have another meeting. I thought I'd be able to announce it today, but it isn't quite set up. But I think there'll be a fertile ground for some of this discussion, because I think there is a lot of energy and concern that's here. And so we had a chance to meet with a lot of the advocates. They'll be coming forward to be talking to us here in the committee, too. But I think it'll be another place where we can have some extended time for conversations. So I just wanted to let you know all know about that. And I believe Jake will be sending that announcement out. I want to thank you for coming forward. I'm sorry, Ms. Langship, but really appreciate your leadership and your help today. And these are really good resources for ongoing involvement questions. So we're going to go to the Department of Health. And I'd like to welcome Commissioner Mangum and it looks like whole staff here. You can introduce yourself. I'm sorry we're running a little later than we thought. We still have a good 20 minutes to listen. And I think what we'll do is let you go ahead and make your presentation and hold questions until we have had a chance to hear from you. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like to introduce Craig Akam, who is my Chief Financial Officer, who's with me here today.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Akam.
Thank you.
You left yourself.
I will try to go through this as quickly as I can and then have some time at the end for questions. I think as you probably heard in the news this past week, you heard a lot about MD-8. You heard about peanut butter and its relationship with salmonella. You heard about nursing homes and concerns about workers and MDH investigations there. You heard about influenza. We're entering into our peak season. It's not too late to get a flu shot if you haven't gotten one already. And this week you will also hear about adverse events. So MDH, Minnesota Department of Health, lead agency for health in the state, is in the news a lot because of the great work that our agency does to protect and maintain and improve the health of all Minnesotans. That's our mission, and I'm here to tell you about that today, give you information and overview, and then be happy to answer any questions. I want to just make a distinction at the very beginning about the difference between individual health or health care and public health, which is population health. And that really is a big distinction. Let me use the example of tobacco. You might, if you're a smoker, you might go in and see your doctor, and your doctor would counsel you to quit smoking and provide advice and provide assistance. That's the individual approach. That's health care. Public health is when the legislature enacted freedom to breathe and made it such that it was smoke-free areas to protect the public health.
Now, as you might expect, public health, for the dollars spent and for the policies enacted, can have a greater impact than doing things one by one by one. You need both, though. You need individual approaches, health care, but you need public health and population approaches. Core functions of public health: assessing the health, what challenges do we face, promoting sound policies, how to address those challenges, and then what's the assurance that we're being effective? So how are we improving health? Now, public health results in longer lives, and this is a graph which just illustrates that. And the CDC, one of our national partners, Centers for Disease Control, would say that public health has added an estimated 25 to 30 years of life in the last century. Now, if you look at that graph, you'll notice a big dip around 1918. Anyone want to guess what happened in 1918 that affected the flu epidemic? Yes, representative. It's the flu epidemic. So that was something that we are preparing for diligently. There were 10,000 deaths in Minnesota at that time. It's estimated when the next pandemic flu comes, not if, when it comes, there will be, in a very severe case, 33,000 Minnesotan deaths and 1.5 million lives affected by pandemic flu. Now, Minnesota, and you'll hear a little bit more later about how we're preparing for that, but that's something we take very seriously. We have groups that are working on that throughout the community. One interesting group is around ethics during a pandemic flu. For example, it's estimated that we would need 12,000 ventilators, so machines that people would be put on to help them breathe in Minnesota in a severe pandemic flu. We have 1,200. So we are engaging the community and discussing now how we would allocate scarce resources at that point, where it is fair, it is transparent, it involves the community in helping us make decisions like that for something such as a pandemic flu. That's public health and engaging the public. Minnesota consistently ranks as one of the healthiest states in the nation. We're very proud of that. It's partly due because of our strong commitment to public health. This past year, with the America Health Rankings, where we get this ranking every year, that the nation as a whole has stagnated in its improvements in health. And Minnesota, unfortunately, was in that area. And in fact, we actually took a decline. Previously, for the last 18 years, we have scored as first or second as the healthiest state in the nation. This past year, we scored fourth. And if you look at our determinants of health and why that is so, it's because of what's happening with obesity, with binge drinking, with children in poverty, with geographic disparities, with our priority for public health. So it is something that we need to be paying attention to. We pride ourselves in being able to produce the outcomes. We still lead in outcomes across the nation, but we need to be looking at our determinants of health. There's six areas of public health that are our responsibility. I won't read them all, but I want to give you, Madam Chair and Representative, a taste of what these core areas of public health responsibility look like. Assuring, the first one is assuring a strong public health system. In 1976, the legislature put together the Community Health Services Act, which established a framework in which 53 counties, cities, areas were designated to actually work collaboratively with the Minnesota Department of Health. So in Minnesota, in contrast to some other states, you have a very strong centralized public health system with your Minnesota Department of Health and a very strong decentralized system that work in partnership. For example, around pandemic flu and emergency preparedness, we have tiers where communities have said, we can comprehensively take care of something, or no, we can only do basic things and we're going to need the state to help us because that's all we have the ability to handle. So we have one of the strongest systems in the country because of this infrastructure that has been put in place and prioritized and invested in over the years. Another way that we assure a strong public health system is by collecting data. Data that we collect are birth and death records.
every year there's about 73,000 births and 38,000 deaths, and we collect those. We are enhancing our systems in this electronic age to make certain that it is very secure and protecting against any identity theft. The second responsibility of public health is to promote healthy communities and eliminate health disparities. We've been working hard since 2002 when the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative was enacted to focus on that area. We've been doing it through partnerships in the communities and with grants and building capacity and leadership and understanding of this important initiative, focusing particularly on things such as infant mortality and infant immunizations and childhood immunizations, adult immunizations, transmitted diseases, breast and cancer, breast and cervical cancer screenings and prevention. So we believe we have done excellent work in this, what I call version 1.0 of eliminating health disparities, and we want to move into version 2.0, in which we will integrate this activity in a greater way within MDH and outside. I tell people by 2050 that the demographics of Minnesota, that the majority population becomes the minority and the minority population becomes the majority. That we will have a different Minnesota, and we really need to capitalize on making certain that the rich cultural and ethnic heritage is incorporated, as well as we have health for all Minnesotans. We want to promote healthy communities, eliminate health disparities. We do this through our WIC program. As you can see, the statewide women, infants, and children's program has been increasing the number of clients that it serves. I think it would be interesting to know that approximately 50% of children born in Minnesota are born to families that are eligible for WIC services. We provide services to approximately 145,000 Minnesota mothers and children. Again, looking at healthy communities and eliminating health disparities, chronic diseases. Chronic diseases are a focus of the Minnesota Department of Health because they're some of the most prevalent, costly, and preventable conditions. Preventable conditions. And one of the most effective ways is of tackling the leading causes of preventable illness and death. And those are listed in your box here of tobacco, physical inactivity, poor nutrition, and alcohol abuse. And I want to take the top two and just show you something, which I hope will illustrate the seriousness of these chronic conditions at this time. I'm going to take you through obesity trends, and I want you to focus on Minnesota. Now, obesity is made up of those two preventable causes I talked about, physical inactivity and unhealthy eating. There is some genetics to obesity, but it's really about those two things. In fact, I talk about the leading preventable causes of illness and death as the three S's: smoking, sitting, and supersizing. So we really need to be thinking about those three things if we're going to have a healthier Minnesota. Now, watch what happens over the years. Now, this comes from data that's collected at the Minnesota Department of Health that's fed in to the CDC. Now, look how Minnesota is continuing to get darker as the rest of the nation is getting darker. So this is the percent of people who are overweight, obese. Doesn't even include all the people who are overweight in that. So this is in 1998, so that's 10 years ago. A thing I want you to note is that this obesity epidemic, and that's what it is, an epidemic, has happened in the last 20 to 25 years. So it's actually something we can turn around. So Minnesota is now at 10 to 14% in 2000 of people who are obese. We now go up in 2002 to 15%. These trends are alarming, and Minnesota is right there with, now we're at 20 to 24% of people in 2007. Go back one. 2007, that's the latest data that we have, are obese. If you combine that with overweight, we now have two-thirds of Minnesotans are obese or overweight. And that has happened in the last 20 to 25 years. We can turn this around. This has not happened over centuries. This has happened within the last 25 years. Why should we care so much about this? It relates to the chronic diseases of obesity is linked to cardiovascular disease, to diabetes, to high blood pressure, even to things like arthritis, degenerative arthritis, wear and tear arthritis. There are so many ways that obesity is a public health disaster and epidemic that needs to be addressed. So, and one of the things is that also the study that we just released, Minnesota Department of Health, in conjunction with Blue Cross in the last year, said if we just held our levels the same now, just held them the same versus continuing this escalation that you've seen, if we could just hold them the same, we could save $3.7 billion in healthcare costs. Think about what dent we could make in our budget deficit right now. We could save $3.7 billion in healthcare costs by 2020. If we could just plateau it, that is achievable. That is achievable. So one of the things I think we can be proud of is that our health reform this past year actually talked about the costs in the state, talked about the unhealthy behaviors, and actually the legislation that was passed, the healthcare reform starts with an investment in public health. And it's called the Statewide Health Improvement Program. Some of you, I'm sure, remember that from last session. It's also, euphemistically, we refer to it as SHIP, and that we actually need to sail this ship into healthier Minnesota with healthier living, better designed cities, so places are more bikeable and walkable, more access to fruits and vegetables, more attention to helping our children not become addicted to smoking, to cigarettes. So look for that, policy and environmental changes that can really, through the SHIP program, get us to a different place and reverse those trends that you saw with obesity. There are other things that the Minnesota Department of Health is doing around healthy communities and eliminating health disparities, working with employers to implement work well programs, putting campaigns together of simple messages around cover your costs. This is one that you may have seen not only in Minnesota but in the United States and internationally. Very simple messages. The whole concept of coughing into your arm sleeve here, covering your cough, started here in Minnesota. Healthy communities through our newborn screening program to detect serious and preventable conditions at the very beginning. I grew up in an era where I remember severe mental retardation and entire institutions that were filled with people with mental retardation, a tragedy for our society back when I grew up. We have the ability, something simple as hypothyroidism, that a child is born with, looks perfectly healthy. We have a way to detect that the minute they are born and get them on treatment. But they don't suffer from having hypothyroidism as a child and develop mental retardation before it's ever detected. But another core responsibility of public health is preventing the spread of infectious disease. And we do that through around-the-clock monitoring that we do for infectious disease. And we have our laboratory, which is in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture, a shared service, again, using the resources wisely in our state to really be able to monitor infectious disease outbreaks and to quickly identify them and put institute interventions to prevent the spread of infectious disease. It's really our pioneering work that has done subtyping that allow us to begin to take the salmonella outbreak and say that the one that's incurring in Minnesota probably is also the one that's incurring across the United States, and we're working very fervently in understanding that at that time. We also track things such as tick-borne illnesses across the state. And I actually have a little show and tell if you're interested about the differences between deer ticks and wood ticks, and educating the public so that people are not overly concerned but do have an appreciation for what a wood tick looks like and what a deer tick looks like, and educational campaigns with consumers. Preventing the spread of infectious disease through immunization and working particularly with our most vulnerable, with our children. And this is just an example of pneumococcal vaccination and getting that out so parents and the public are incorporating that into their healthcare system. And you can see the dramatic decrease just in the metro area of the cases of pneumococcal disease because of the immunization program. That's spreading infectious disease. Another core responsibility is making environments safe and healthy. And we do that through an assurance that the water you drink is clean and the food you eat is safe. I happened to hear a colonel in our reserve forces who's in Iraq talk about being there and how we forget about something simple like this, of the food that is being safe and the water we drink being clean when you go to another country that doesn't have that kind of infrastructure in place for it. So we actually are, one of the ways that we do that you might not be aware of is that we are sealing unused wells. There are about 750,000 unused wells in Minnesota right now. And if you are aware that ground contaminants can get into those wells unless they are sealed and then contaminate our entire groundwater. So we are in the process of working with people who have these wells to seal them. So we, and at this point, we have about a third of them sealed, again, protecting our groundwater. We also collect and analyze more than 150,000 drinking samples, drinking water samples each year to assure the public that it has safe drinking water. All newly constructed private wells are tested for the presence of bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic. We also work with restaurant managers to develop food safety protocols and systems, not just inspections, but really food protocols and systems to protect food safety. And there are more than 20,000 licensed establishments in Minnesota that we work with. We make environments safe and healthy through advice about reducing risk. We live in a world that has chemicals that are released into the air and water and soil. We work closely with Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, to really investigate and understand the risks associated with chemical exposure. We also, floods and tornadoes are, it's a fact of life in Minnesota. We work carefully with communities who are impacted by floods and tornadoes. We offer free testing of wells once floods have happened to make certain that water sources are safe. And we provide information about how people can clean up and protect themselves and their families after floods. So thinking about risk, we are most pleased that the legislature authorized us to do biomonitoring and environmental health tracking this past year, especially related to health and cancer risk. This past year, we have focused on perfluorochemicals in water, arsenic in soil, mercury in the Great Lakes Basin, and bisphenol A in collaboration with the University of Minnesota. Making environments safe and healthy, we do investigations into novel illnesses. You remember about this time last year when we had an outbreak of an unusual neurological disease in a pork processing plant. And it was through our investigations as well as our work with all of our partners and our collaborators that we were able to determine that it was really a pressurized gun that was blowing the brains out of the pork, which our state epidemiologist saw the mist in the air that the workers were being exposed to that was essentially setting up an allergic reaction that was causing this strange pattern of neurological illnesses. Not only did we find it here, but through collaborating with others across the country, that we were able to determine that was happening in other plants in other states. And so that has been eliminated, and since that processing, that particular aspect of that processing has been eliminated, there have been no more cases of that unusual neurological illness. We could not have done it without all of our partners that are located, are mentioned there, as well as working carefully with the Mayo Clinic to determine the cause and the etiology of this neurological illness.
Commissioner, just let me interrupt for a second. We're just about out of time, but I'm just, I know you've got some more to go through, and committee members, I'm just wondering if you're willing to stay another 5 minutes or so. Commissioner, stay with us. Is that okay? Maybe hit the highlights. I'm sorry we're short on time today, but we are going to have you back, too.
Okay. I'll continue to go quickly. Preparing for disasters and emergencies, as I said before, we're working carefully around pandemic flu as well as other disasters, floods, tornadoes, chemical spills, Ham Lake fire, other incidents. To make certain that we are prepared as well as all of local public health is prepared. We have prepare for disasters and emergencies by exercises such as this one that you saw, in which the, at the Minneapolis Convention Center, metro area hospitals practice setting up a care center in case of a disaster. We help, the last responsibility is we help all people get quality health services. We provide information to policymakers so you can make wise decisions. This is a graph of the cumulative healthcare cost growth versus other economic indicators. And as Governor Plenty would say, healthcare cost is a runaway train here. And we are really working through our healthcare reform designed to improve the population health so less services are needed, to reward value, not volume of services. We have several initiatives around care coordination, baskets of care so people will be transparent around what care they are getting and how much it costs, quality incentive payments, and as well as letting people be able to find quality and cost information. Last, we do assurance of that appropriate care is happening in nursing homes. We inspect over 1,000 nursing home or healthcare facilities annually. We handle complaints of 400 to 500 a year by on-site visits. We issue corrections and penalties, and we have made a nursing home report card available ever since 2006. We work carefully with rural communities to make certain that we have a vibrant infrastructure in the rural area to address the healthcare needs in the state, helping them with workforce shortage issues, access to certain providers, facilities, and shortage. In addition, we have a statewide trauma system that's been enacted in the last year to make certain people are getting the care they need during trauma. Our current priorities are strategically prevention, as I have mentioned, making certain Minnesotans are protected against public health threats, and healthcare reform so that you as policymakers can have health, instead of investing so much in health care, you can get upstream to it to be able to invest and prioritize the social determinants of health, such as education and housing and economic development and prevention. Where does our funding come from? We'll talk more about that once the detail after the governor unveils his budget. But I just wanted to say that we get it from multiple sources, very diverse sources. The federal government represents our largest funding source of 42%. The state general fund provides only 14% of our funding, but it's absolutely critical because it allows me to be able to put it into places that their holes, as well as to have the management team to make certain that I have a good system and good management in place to be using the other funds that we're getting wisely in the proper way. Where does our funding go? The majority of our fund, almost two-thirds, goes out in grants to local units of government, community-based organizations, tribal governments, and educational institutions. Only 39% of the funding supports MDH-based operations and activities and funds my nurses, well inspectors, scientists, engineers, microbiologists, and the expertise at that MDH. We have a wealth of information. Please visit our website. You'd be surprised that we get 11 million hits per month to the MDH website. We are a real source of information and expertise for the state to keep the state healthy. Our location, we're close by, so my staff and myself are available to you in any way to continue to fulfill our mission of protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of all Minnesotans. A final word about public health. It's one of the best investments that the government can make. It's by preventing problems before they occur that we can help save lives and save money. And we want to keep Minnesota ranking as one, if not the healthiest state in the nation, as one of the healthiest states in the nation. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative, for your time. And I'd be happy to stay. I know you need to go to answer any questions or answer any questions you'll have.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any burning questions right now for the Commission? We sure do appreciate your being here. Anyone who has a question? Yes. Okay, well, I think we'll take you up, though, on the offer to continue the dialogue, and I really do appreciate you coming by today, both of you. Thank you. The committee is adjourned.